for the second presentation by Jean-Baptiste Pollin. JB is with the Eurospin unit in CEA in France, and is going to tell us about group analysis in FMRI.
So, it's okay. Just that we didn't use the xylophone. I'm sorry, the title of the talk has changed a bit. I mean, I thought I could do more talk about the group analysis in general. Some aspect of group analysis anyway. I'm at Eurospin now, and I would first like to acknowledge some of the my collaborators I must acknowledge mostly Bertrand Thirion here, because a lot of the slides that you will see are coming from him. So I'd like to do that to start, starting first. So this is just a quick slide on a advertisement for our new center. it's a very large neuroimaging building with 130, 170, and maybe in some years, an 11 Tesla machine. So it's a very interesting place, and I hope that many of you will be visiting or at some stage. Anyway, I thought I would start this talk with a word on a bit of a general word on fMRI and methods. Because I'm getting old, and I'm kind of thinking, just trying to see all the methods in the fMRI world, what can we classify them somehow? And I wanted to do this classification, and I thought that the first one is really the good ideas that people have and that don't require any technology. You've seen some very complex models. You will see some very complex models of many things, but there are a few excellent ideas in the literature that actually require nothing. A coefficient correlation or an addition or whatever. And I really like those things. I'm just going to show you one example of that. There's many works that are actually doing some kind of technology transfer. So basically, you have a good method in applied mathematics, so you've got a good method to new methods for resolving model, Bayesian model, or whatever, and then you apply that to a good question, and that's a good transfer of technology. I like that. There's also bad transfer of technology that, you've got this method and you have to use it, and whatever the question. And that's very common as well in the literature. And then there's a large number of work that basically are extremely complex often never used. Only on the one data sample that has been used for demonstrating that the methods work. And that's a large amount of work as well. So I would really encourage you to be in the two first class of this small classification. I'm not going to talk about the methods that are wrong. There are some, of course, and I've done some. But that's an important issue. If you're going to do some effort in fMRI, basically try to see to be in the two first ones. So I would like just to, again, to give an example of a gem. In 2004, Halston and the group of Malak did this fantastic study where they showed a movie to their subjects and basically asked the questions, which are the voxels? So there was no paradigm. They were showing the bad, the good, and the ugly. and there was no paradigm at all in the just showing this movie to the subjects. And the idea was well, let's look at the voxels that actually have the same time course or correlating time course between pairs of subjects, and let's highlight the areas of the brain that have the same time course between subjects. And that was enough. And then doing some reverse correlation to actually look at what was in the film that had provoked such a correlation and the increase of bold signal. So you see, in this kind of work, there was absolutely nothing in terms of technology, but it was just a brilliant idea, and that's 4 years ago. And then fMRI has been gone from 92 or so. So that's just a very good idea, and there's a few in the literature like that which are really good, and that's just using correlation of coefficient, but answering a good question: what are the brain regions that are the same across subjects watching the same thing? Anyway, I really like this work, so I thought I could start with this talk with. So my presentation will start with a kind of a general introduction of what should we do to average subjects. Then I will go into showing you a couple of works that we've been doing on trying to find some other solutions than the standard solutions, and then I will go into reliability of our group analysis. I think the next challenges will probably won't have time to go down. We've covered that yesterday anyway. So if you want to do group analysis, you have to solve for two problems. Basically, you have to match the position of the signal between subjects, and you also have to do the inference aspect of the group analysis. So there's very little. There are solutions for those two problems, but I think the first one is the most difficult, and that's the one I will concentrate on. I won't concentrate on the inference problem. And it's also a talk that is, is largely on ongoing work. So if it asks more questions and provide answers, then so the context of the work is the classical approach. So the classical approach, I think you know it rather well now, is that you take your subject, you do a non-rigid matching to match the anatomical template, and then some special smoothing to account for the differences in the brands, and then an estimation, and then group analysis at the inference level. And that's extremely useful and extremely important to do. And I would never ever think of removing this general framework in some ways, because it's so important to have the same space to generalize findings to population, but also to compare population, to compare studies, to be able to, in some kind of ways, having a first approximation of where your activations are, whatever the brain shape that you're studying, and of the subject you're studying, and so on. So, and there's also a great deal of packages that are providing software for doing that, and that's also one of the components of the success of the method, is that it is actually available to do for cognitive neuroscientists. So there's a large number, and I guess last week was mostly dedicated to a lot of the methods that we've seen last week are dedicated to actually finding a good solution for doing this transformation. And there's a large number of work doing this often. So the question is more. The question is more philosophical than that. How do we, how should we average between the two brains? What is the good, neuroscience measure to do that? Let's start with the anatomical, localization, and see. Once again, this normalization, the spatial normalization that we're all using, is relying largely on the on the gross correspondence between the function and the anatomy and the gross anatomy. It's not relying on some very fine features of your brain. It's relying on the gross anatomy aspect of it. So what you're matching really is basically the shape of the brain, some contrast in the T1 image that are, you know, like ventricles and things like that. But you're matching gross aspect of the brain. I mean, of course, you've got better and better solutions with working on the surface and so on. We will go into that quickly, but it's a very rough approximation. And it's got a lot of problems. I'm sure you've seen many of those already. But I mean, just a simple problem of having the EPI images in the exactly the same space as the T1 images, given the distortion of the EPI images and the loss of signal in some part of the brain, is already quite a bit of a challenge. And that's one thing, but also, you know, just having the, you know, the right correspondence between the Telerik atlas and the template, which is shown here. So you see that, you know, the classical miscorrespondence of the Telerik atlas and the MNI template, and also all the problems of the of having too many degrees of freedom in your matching and things like that. And so the question is, Is that the proper thing to do? I mean, that's the main question, really. There's a very nice. It was already an old work, but an extremely important one from Bruce Fischer, and you probably have seen it already as well. And that's he was actually solving much better the problem by trying to transform the cortical surface. Firstly, transform the cortical surface to a sphere, and then assign the gray value encoding for the local convexity, or possibly for the depth of the sulci, and then, you know, matching this sphere together, and that should have been shown to provide a much better functional correspondence between the brains, and that's the important measure somehow. After spatial normalization, you get a stronger overlap between your functional signals. Then that's it's not a validation per se, because but it's a good sign that you've done something a bit more proper than the previous method. So there's many practical problems with that. I mean, just getting the cortical surface is one. Getting a good cortical surface is not that easy, and it's also again needs a very fine correspondence between the T1 and the T2 star images. And there's also a philosophical problem that you're not too sure that matching the depth or the convexity is the thing that you should be doing as well. So there's a lot of work on trying to find individual anatomical region of interest. And basically, to get something quickly said, it's very difficult to do as well, because you don't know really how to define. I mean, some of the regions of interest are easy to define because they are the basal ganglia, things like that. But in many of the cortical regions, you don't actually know how to define those, and it's very long and difficult to do. And the automatic definition of that is not really robust or ready yet. I mean, that's for sure. You've probably seen the many atlases as well. So there's trying to parcelate the brain in the atlas and then matching your subject brain into this atlas, and that's fine, because that's a good solution, because it's an easy one to do. But it really is a gross solution as well. It's very rough as a good matching between two brains. So basically, the current whole brain normalization techniques are difficult to quantify the accuracy of those. And the spatial mismatch between the brain results in blurring the signal between subjects. So one of the alternative solutions that is emerging is actually to try to find some good landmarks in the individual brains, but that's that's also a difficult thing to do automatically, and it's also something that you will not actually get sure that it's going to be a good solution at the end of the day. So I'd just like to go into a very quick word on functional localization. So one of the things that has been developed over the years by many groups, and especially the Kanishal group, is to basically, the idea is to you define your correspondence between subjects in terms of the functional signal rather than the anatomical space. So you basically do the same paradigm to many subjects, and then you define region of interest where you have signals in the rough same anatomical area, and then you define those signals to be the region of interest of those subjects. And that's how you match subjects to each other. And that's a very good solution in a way, because what you've been matching is actually the functional signal, and therefore you've been matching regions that have roughly the same aspect in terms of function. So there are very issues about this technique as well. It means that you concentrate on a few regions and that you're not looking at the full brain, and there's other questions on how do you define those regions of interest and so on. But that's a completely different way of matching two brains, and it's probably a good one at many places because you're really sure that you're going to look at the same functional structure somehow between subjects. And that's a very excellent study where you see the paracompal place area defined in 9 subjects. And you see when you've got this kind of signal in 9 subjects, and they are so much alike and so well delimited in the brain, that you're pretty sure that you're doing something very solid in terms of your experiment. That's probably one of the it's a great demonstration of brain imaging here. So why is it so difficult? I mean, and basically, the difficulty comes from the variability between our brains. And here is the circular anatomy, I mean, with the work of Cachier, Rivière, and Mangin, especially at Neurospin, there's a big group doing these sort of things. And here you see that the circuit of different brains are quite variable. I mean, possibly the deep point of those circuits are less variable, but the general circuit is very variable across subjects, and it's extremely difficult to find a correspondence between those things. I mean, if you try to do a point-to-point matching between those things, it's going to be extremely difficult. And in some places, you'll never be able to say which one is going to relate to which one. It's too variable somehow. If you got two circuits instead of one, I mean, what do you do? So the cytoarchitectony, of course, is also has been shown to be extremely variable. So the early work from Garcilas lab, of course, but it shows that in some areas in those areas only they match by only 50% of the subject, or 50% or more. But you've got many areas between those 10 subjects that are making this image. Between those 10 subjects, you've got many places where you've got only one or two subjects showing the same kind of Brodmann area. So it is difficult also to do in terms of those studies are difficult to do in terms of getting the delimitation of the Brodmann areas per subject and so on. Basically what they show is that there is an important variability when you put those cytoarchitectonic maps between subjects in the same in the MNI template or in the Tabarrok framework. Once again, Bruce Fisher have worked on those things and shown that the variability on the cortical surface is much less between of the cytoarchitectonic areas. And it's interesting to see that the variability is quite different. I mean, might be quite different for instance, the visual cortex, we've got very good matching between subjects using the cortical surface and the sulci and the main sulci. But also, it's much less good in some areas where you see much greater variation between subjects in the cytoarchitectonic, and because there is less good sulci landmarks to work with. So you've seen already the variability in the functional world. And you know that's a very clear demonstration of that. That's the same task being done by Vaital in 9 subjects, actually in 8 subjects, and each subject being done being rescanned for 9 times with 9 sessions. You see that you know the inter-subject variability is at the functional level is much stronger than the inter-session variability. The inter-session variability is kind of more like a threshold issue rather than a fundamental issue. But you basically see here that the inter-subject variability. I mean, you can get some not only the position but also the amount of signal. But also, I mean, you may have different networks in this task. I mean, this was a two back memory task. So what do we do? I mean. So we've got a huge amount of variability due to the intra-subject variability or the inter-subject variability, and once again the problem is that we've got small scale variability that the position of the activation may not be exactly the same place between subjects. We might also have some large scale variability that some subjects have a different network and. You may or may not be interested in knowing that which networks are different. I mean, it's kind of a difficult position where we don't know how to match those subjects because we have to first find what is the small scale variability and the large scale variability to actually be able to try to see how to get those subjects together. So So I'm going to try to show you what kind of path we've taken to approach this problem along the years, and one of the recent work that has been done by Merlin Keller and Alexis Roche recently is to set exactly the same framework of the voxel analysis in the MNI template in the Dirac Atlas template. Is to encode for a possible variation of the activity in the at the voxel level. So basically, you're thinking that the activity might be displaced in another subject, and you encode this spatial displacement as being for instance a normal with some variation, and you use a small variation between subject to factor somehow the variability between subjects, and that's a very interesting framework. I mean, you're searching for a small displacement across subjects in the usual voxel wise group analysis, and the results are not terribly different from what you would expect from the spatial relaxation with unsmoothed data. And that's the permutation technique used on smooth data, so kind of a gold standard group analysis technique. And what you see basically is that you get fundamentally the same results with maybe smaller regions. I mean, the regions are kind of more better defined using the relaxation technique, the reason is really in the model that they're using for that. That's an interesting framework. I mean, that's a first step towards dealing with the inter-subject variability at the small scale level. So, really, in an ideal world, what we would like to do is match across subjects something and get something which are homogeneous, not only in terms of the function but also in terms of the anatomical structure which is underlying the function, and provide a way of taking into account both the anatomical and the functional variability. Possibly detect what are the large scale outliers in the group. So that's a few equations are gone now, but doesn't matter. Let me recall very quickly the principle of many clustering techniques. And here I'm just putting a slide for those who are not aware of the simple Kamin's technique. Clustering techniques, where you basically extract the points that are the closer to some seed points, and you run a kind of EM algorithm to get the best classification in those points. That's a very general technique, and I remember a long time ago what we tried to do is actually use that as a filter using the anatomy for getting some small region of interest in the gray matter, and using that kind of technique we were able to actually define some nice little region of interest across the gray matter, and then use those little region of interest, varying the region of interest, somehow varying the little anatomical parcels, and get the functional signal in those parcels, and see that which is very homologous to a filtering technique, to the Gaussian filtering technique, and matching the number of parcels with the smoothing kernel, we could see that it gave us more sensitivity. And also of course a better definition of where is the activity for one brain, but that would work only for a single subject analysis. That was the point. So still using the clustering techniques. Oops, I think that's a bit. Still using the clustering techniques. We're thinking now in terms of clustering. About the same in terms of the functional activity across different contrasts for different voxels, and that was exactly using the same technique, trying to see the voxel that's at here in six different conditions or contrasts of interest. You would record the activity of those contrasts for each voxel, and then try to group those voxels that have the same kind of activity across the experimental conditions, and that is an interesting technique because that would define some functional regions that have the same kind of a range of activity across a range of contrast conditions. And that's a very useful technique that probably is not yet used very much because it's got its problem. You have to define in this instance. You have to define the number of classes and things like that. But that was a first step in terms of grouping things that have the same functional activity. So that's the paper of Simon and et al. Showing the result of that for the kind of a parcellation, a functional parcellation of the parietal cortex, showing how the parietal cortex in those various tasks is actually functionally parcellated. So Now the simplest. I mean, I've shown you some kind of clustering techniques for getting some small region of interest on the anatomy of one subject. And I've shown you that you can group things that are functionally equivalent across voxels only functionally. Obviously, the thing to do is to try to the next step would be to try to get some voxels that have both the same kind of the same kind of position in the brain and also the same kind of functional activity in the brain, and that's the idea of this. This is just a schematic view of that, where you've got the activity here of this simulated region that you can see that these are the regions that would be defined anatomically only grouping the voxels that are close to each other, and these are the regions that are used if you try to embed the functional activity in this grouping. These are the regions that would be defined. So that's basically the idea of our first work on those lines, where instead of trying to group voxels that are either close functionally or anatomically, we were basically trying to group those voxels that are both that are both at about the same place and also have about the same functional activity. And we used for that, and Guillaume Fonda used for that a Gaussian mixture model. That you would run that across subjects as well. So basically, a cross subject, you would try to find classes where you have the same kind of XYZ coordinate in the Tarak system and the same kind of functional activity in a series of contrast. And that was, I mean, I was giving already some interesting results. That would right away, you know, adapt for each different subject, adapt the different activity, for instance, here in the prefrontal cortex, the different activity and the size of the region of interest defined using this classification technique, this clustering technique, detect some kind of automatically detect, you know, the subject which wouldn't be able to that the cluster wouldn't allow for any voxels to be in the cluster. So it is kind of a data-driven clustering techniques that would the philosophy of it is that it extracts things that are both, you know, functionally and anatomically in a closed space. And that's that would give us some interesting results. So there's a number of difficulties with this solution, and the difficulty is that there's no explicit model for intra-subject activity. That there is also it's not a proper generative model. The next solution that Bertrand developed is to use some kind of hierarchical parcellation techniques, where at the group level you define the same sort of parcellation technique at the group level, and then you have some prototype of parcels at the group level, and then you try to find at each subject the best adapting parcel that would still be close in the space, in the anatomical space, and also close in the functional space, but allow for some small displacement in the XYZ coordinates. And that's been using spectral clustering and isomap techniques. And you see, using just one contrast, how this algorithm would define slightly different parcels across subjects and adapt for this sort of variability, small scale variability. And if you use more than one contrast, if you use several contrasts, then of course the functional space that you're using for defining those little regions of interest automatically is more rich, is richer, and it gives you different information depending on where you are in the brain. And here we're using, for instance, actually we're using eight or ten different contrasts. Can you hear me? Okay. We're using eight or ten different contrasts across the subjects, and that would define the parcellation. And that's, for instance, an example of the intersubject variability at the motor cortex parcel. And the inference on that is feasible. It's not very easy because you have to account for the fact that you've been defining those little regions of interest using the functional activity. So you have to do permutation techniques and then redo the whole clustering techniques and parcellation technique to find the distribution of the activity under the null. But that's feasible. And once you've done that, if you do that, you can see that so that's the result of a parcellation technique and the standard analysis. And then when you do that, and you correct for multiple comparison, you might sometimes get much more sensitive. In this case, we get much more sensitive in these regions. So that's one of the issue, of course, is how many parcels you define. This is one of the key parameter that you would like to control, and the region. And the number of regions you can actually set, because we've got a proper statistical model for the likelihood, then you can set the number of parcels using cross validation or big techniques. That's It's very easy to do. It's just long, and it's just the cross validation is long to compute, but it's easy. And in this specific instance, I'm not saying that it is a general result, but in this specific data set, we found something like that a good description is about between 40 and 60 100 parcels, for instance. So you start to get an adaptive way, a definition of small region of interest across subjects that are defined by their functional properties, but also have some kind of a validation in terms of their closeness in the anatomical space. So another route that can be taken that probably is more interesting is what we call functional landmark or structural approach for neuroimaging. So let me go quickly into this in the idea. The idea here is that you define for each subject some things that are important at the subject level, and then you will try to see across subject what is reproducible and what would actually correspond to each other, and then add up in terms of the signal. So the pipeline here is that you extract the blob, you do a mixture model to get some region of interest significance. You do that for many subjects, and then you Bertrand used the directly processed mixture model to get the inter-subject aspect of the problem, and then get the RI posterior probability, and then you can he went even further and got to try to match the different little RIs between subjects. So let me give you a couple of picture on that. So this is the way it's called the images. It's kind of a hierarchical in terms of the intensity description of the blobs. And then you simplify the thing such that you get regions this is a classical contrast of T maps per subject, and this is the description of the blobs that you will end up with using this thing. And what's important here is that you're not using all the voxels at the end of the day. You're using a synthetic description of each subject activity to go further at the inter-subject level. And so you associate a probability using a gamma Gaussian mixture model as Mark Ulrich has done in the Oxford group, and so you associate to that a probability at the intra-subject level, and then you try to get the significance of the regions at the inter-subject level using the fact that you may have other regions in the same about at the same place in between subjects. So I'm not going into the model, the generative model, but that's a proper generative model to do that. Using the same kind of a model that you've seen yesterday afternoon by Tim, you can get the posterior probability of those components of the activity of each region and of the position as well of the region. So using the inference model on the either the alternative hypothesis or the null hypothesis, which have different likelihood. And all those estimations are done of those probability are done using Gibbs sampling. So that's the basic. So the result of that is that you do get at the individual data some maps that are very different as you can see, but using this modeling techniques, inter-subject modeling techniques, then you can get the what are the regions that are actually reinforcing themselves because they are present at several subjects in several subjects. And then that's another thing, but then you can actually associate the different regions between subjects. If this subject here has this and this regions, you can try to associate those regions between subjects, and that's using belief propagation trees and also extracting maximum clicks from the corresponding graph using some replicator dynamics, a technique that has been introduced, I guess, by Gabriele Lohmann in neuroimaging. So you can get, at the end of the guide, that you get activated regions that are reinforcing themselves across subjects and that are about at the same place. And that's in a reasonable computing time because you have worked with a synthetic aspect of each individual subject data. And that's some of the results of the, getting the, some region of the brain in one contrast using the language understanding contrast, computation minus language understanding, and that and you see that it does show a good sensitivity, and it also gives you not only a group template but also an implementation of this group template per subject. So per subject, you will be able to see what are the actual activity of this specific subject in the group model. And that's a very interesting thing because then you can try to see what are the at each subject you can see the correlation between those regions with, let's say, another behavioral data or another interesting measurement that you've done at the subject level. Another thing that is interesting is that you can try to localize those and see whether the coordinate system that may be given by the main sulci is a better coordinate system than the standard space coordinate system. And that's a work by Alan Tucholka et al. At Neurospin. And that basically, once you've done the functional landmarks determination across subjects, you're trying to see whether those functional landmarks are actually using the sulci that are close to those functional landmarks. Here, let's say these three sulci around, trying to see whether this information is actually giving you a better prediction of what is the another subject activity is going to be. So if another subject activity is going to be more better predicted with this new coordinate system, then of course you have a gain in terms of what you've learned from the position of the brain. So that's what's been shown here for three different functional landmarks and using those different main sulci defined in each individual brain. But it's not a general thing. It worked for those three landmarks. It didn't work for other landmarks, and that's because mainly it will depend on the reliability on the definition of the anatomical feature between subjects. So I'm a bit late in this talk. I wasn't too well prepared, but I want to say a word on the reliability of group analysis because that's another very important aspect of the work. And the basic problem is that if you take 10 subjects, we used a database of something like 100 subjects in this study. And basically, if you take 10 subjects, 10 different subjects, and do a random effect analysis on the same sort of contrast, then you would see this sort of this kind of results. So, and if you do if you report the significant results of those analyses, you will see that the significant results of a group analysis using 10 subjects are going to be varying quite a lot between those analyses, just because you've taken 10 different subjects. And the question is how, and that's the group analysis of I think it was 80 subjects or something like that. So you see, one of the problems in the literature is that people report a significant group analysis results, but because the number of subjects in the group analysis is quite little, it's between 10 and 15, maybe 20 sometimes. It's the actual report of those is very unreliable. I mean, it's very strong signal you will find always, but all the signals that are less strong and then you might report in one group analysis and not the other and so on. So using two different measure for the reliability of the group analysis. So a measure of the the Kappa index here, and a measure of the reliability of the position of the cluster that you found between between groups analysis. I'm just keeping quite quickly. You can show that using different statistics for this group analysis. You can show that you got some interesting results on the on the number of subjects. That's the thing that I would like you to concentrate on. The number of subjects that you really require to have reliable group analysis techniques is between 20 and 27 here in this specific instance. And I think that's probably quite kind of a general result. If you really want to have reproducible group analysis techniques results, then most of the time you would have to have more than 20 subjects in your study. So that's an important aspect, and that was also the way of trying to detect what is the best statistical technique to what is the best statistical test to would give the most reliable results. And we found that something based on clusters or parcels is actually getting better, and something based on the on mixed effect analysis will also give you better results. More reliable results. So I'm just going to skip that. Just to finish up. One of the things that we think is important is that once you've got information at the subject level, but still having a group model for that, it's kind of easy to get distances between subjects. Here we can see this is dendrograms of the distances between 100 subjects, and it's easy to try to get to find some cluster of those subjects, which are probably more accurate in the sense that they have a content. Those measures have a content for the small displacement that the activity can be where the activity can be between subjects, and also it's easier to also try to correlate some other behavioral signals, some other behavioral measures with the functional MRI signal using those kind of techniques. And I think that's it. I would like just to emphasize that one of the aspects which will be very important in the future is to get those measures and those models into some database place where you can actually grow with the information that you have at the subject level, but also at the group level. You can accumulate results, and also emphasize that we need more neuroinformatics tools to actually fill in to get those databases and further methods for analyzing those databases. Thank you very much. Obviously, it's not a proper method to actually try to detect your outliers and then remove them and then analyze the data again. The way to do that is to actually use some robust measure, robust statistics measure. That's probably the way to go rather than trying to detect the outliers and remove them from the group. In this specific instance, it wasn't. We just used a different set of statistics, so some are more robust than the others. We didn't actually do something specific for the outliers. And I think we shouldn't. We should use a proper statistic in that you would account for the fact that you may have some outliers, but still is describing the group results properly. This is a specific data set. So with a very strong signal, you may go down to 15 subject and 10 subject and be good, in terms of reproducibility. But in most studies, I think 20 to 25 subjects is a minimum. Yes.
I have a question.
So what we use is the Malabnobis distance between a set of contrast. So you have a set of contrast per subject, and you've got contrast values or beta values for those subjects. For one voxel, you may have a set of beta values, and we use the Malabnobis distance between those beta values. So basically, the distance between those beta values accounting for their covariance.
And how do you weight the functional and transform?
So that's a very good point. We use some coming heuristic for the weighting to start with, and basically using the heuristic of the number of parcels basically would be how much. How much partial you define is basically weighting the amount of clustering that you do in the anatomical space, but that's also the reason why we went to other techniques than this one, because the spatial model and the intensity model should be kind of quite should be different somehow. I mean it's not a very good model to put everything in the same GRM. So that's the reason of one of the further advance of some further work that Bastiat's been done doing. Yeah.
Jean-Baptiste, just to follow up on Gary's question, so this is young normal controls, right?
Yeah.
So we might expect that as we go into disease or as a function of age, that number's going to have to go up.
That's correct.
Which
yeah.
would suggest that the literature, by and large, is pretty.
I think so. I think the literature is showing a lot of results that they're not wrong. The results that are shown are probably good, but the fact that the results are not reliable is mostly due to a false negative aspect of the analysis. So basically, one group might describe a set of region, and another group will describe a set of region, and this set will intersect a little bit, but in fact. Probably they would interest much better if they had more subjects. I think that's right. We need more subjects, which is painful and costly. But, yeah.
So